I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 27th, and we have a lot to talk about. I'm in West Palm Beach, Florida this week, attending the 2024 ACTRIMS Forum. ACTRIMS is an acronym for the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. And the 9th annual meeting gets underway on February 29th and runs through March 2nd, attracting researchers, clinicians, medical residents, and postdoctoral fellows who come ready to take a deep dive into some of the novel scientific discoveries being made in MS that ultimately impact MS care. Each year, the ACTRIMS Forum adopts a theme, and the theme for this year's meeting is Breaking Barriers in MS. Attendees can look forward to 3 days of discussions and presentations related to breaking the barriers that create healthcare disparities and limit access to care, penetrating the barriers and borders of the central nervous system, overcoming impediments to neural repair, removing roadblocks to rehabilitation, and making choices in clinical trial design that make trials more feasible and informative. Speaking of being informative, Professor Alan Thompson joins me today to help clarify some terms you may already be hearing. One of the terms we're talking about is progression independent of relapse activity, which is often referred to by the acronym PIRA. If you're part of the majority of people living with MS who've been diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS, you may find the concept of progression independent of relapse activity to be confusing. The other term we're looking at today is not quite a medical or scientific term, but it's certainly one we're hearing more frequently, and that term is smoldering MS. It's a potentially worrisome term, and in just a few minutes, Professor Thompson will be on hand to hopefully resolve any confusion and lay to rest some of those worries. Professor Thompson has been the recipient of virtually every high honor and award that's given in the field of multiple sclerosis research, including the John Distel Prize for MS Research in 2017, the Sobeck Research Prize in 2020, and the 2021 Charcot Award, which recognizes a lifetime of achievement in outstanding research into understanding and treating MS. But before we get to my conversation with Professor Alan Thompson, there are a few other things that you should know about. As we've reported in previous episodes of the podcast, we're beginning to see mounting evidence that supports the use of so-called high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies as effective first-line treatments for MS. Now, newly published research makes the case that the same may be true when it comes to treating pediatric MS. In managing MS, the goal of any disease-modifying therapy is to prevent relapses, reduce the accumulation of disability over time, and reduce brain inflammation. So-called high-efficacy DMTs are powerful medications that have been shown to do a better job of reducing an individual's relapse rate, but carry with them more potential side effects. It's still common among adults living with MS to begin treatment with a moderately effective disease-modifying therapy, and then escalate to a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy if and when they experience further disease activity. But for kids and teens living with MS, the FDA hasn't approved any high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies, so these more powerful medicines are often being prescribed off-label. A research team in France wanted to better understand and document the effect of high-efficacy DMTs on pediatric MS patients. So they analyzed data from 36 MS centers throughout France and focused on patients who were diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS and who received their first treatment with a disease-modifying therapy before age 18 in the years 2010 through 2022. Of the 530 children who were identified, 20% were initially treated with a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy, and 79.6% were initially treated with a moderately effective therapy. The mean age of the children was 16 years. About 69% were girls, and these patients were followed for an average of almost 6 years. The most commonly used moderately effective therapies included interferon beta-1a, glatiramer acetate, and Tecfidera, while the most commonly used high-efficacy therapies were Tysabri, Gilenya, and Novantrone. The most common reasons for switching from one of the moderately effective therapies was intolerability and ineffectiveness as measured by new MRI activity, and the risk of discontinuing a therapy was shown to be higher among the children on a moderately effective DMT. 2 years after beginning treatment, the pediatric patients being treated with a high-efficacy DMT showed a 66% decrease in MRI activity compared with the pediatric patients being treated with a moderately effective DMT. The study revealed that among the more than 500 pediatric MS patients, treatment with a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy was associated with a 54% lower risk of a first relapse over 5 years compared with treatment with a moderately effective DMT. And so, evidence from this study makes a strong argument that kids living with MS will experience better outcomes if they're put on a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy at the time of diagnosis. Hopefully, our governmental regulators are taking note. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Results from a small study in Norway show that about 4 in 5 people with relapsing remitting MS who received autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, remained free of relapses, experienced no disability worsening, and showed no new disease activity on MRI for at least 6 years. The study involved 29 adults with a mean age of 31 who had experienced at least 2 relapses in the year before receiving their stem cell transplant. Most of the 29 people in the study had tried between 2 and 4 disease-modifying therapies, and for almost 6 years following their stem cell transplant, 2/3 of the study participants showed no evidence of disease activity. 21% of the study participants did show new areas of disease activity on MRI, 17% experienced a relapse, and 10% had confirmed disability progression. 38% of the study participants actually showed improvement in their level of disability. And making what I'll call an important real-world observation, many of the people who were treated with HSCT were able to return to the workforce. Now, before receiving autologous HSCT, only 1 of the 29 study participants worked full-time. At the end of 2 years, 10 study participants were working full-time, and at the end of 5 years, 15 study participants were working full-time. Very often, our work plays a significant role in how we define ourselves, how we see ourselves, and how others perceive us. To be able to return to the workforce after MS has forced you out has got to be an amazing feeling. The results of this small study go beyond the fact that the majority of study participants showed no evidence of disease activity for 6 years following their stem cell transplant. The study results also provide evidence of important ancillary benefits that accrue with autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Once someone is diagnosed with MS, the question of if or when their disease will progress is never far from top of mind. And one of the most frustrating aspects of multiple sclerosis is that it's impossible to answer that question. But we may see that start to change. An international team of researchers has announced that they've developed an artificial intelligence-based tool that can predict the evolution of people diagnosed with MS. Now, I want to make it clear that this is a first-generation effort, and this tool is not ready to be used in clinical practice. But it's a real step forward in being able to answer a question that's on the mind of everyone living with MS. In developing this tool, the researchers followed over 300 people who were living with MS and over 100 people who didn't have MS, who served as controls in the study. These study participants were followed for 2 years, and they were given multiple MRI exams, as well as a type of imaging called optical coherence tomography, which is used to track changes in the thickness of the retinal nerve fiber. A detailed genetic profile was developed for each study participant, and the proteins and inflammatory cells found in their blood was measured. Using a type of artificial intelligence called machine learning, the team was able to develop algorithms for predicting confirmed disability accumulation and no evidence of disease activity, which is commonly referred to by the acronym NEDA. The team also developed algorithms for predicting the onset of immunotherapy and the escalation from low to high efficacy disease-modifying therapies with medium to high accuracy. The AI-powered tool that was developed was shown to be useful in predicting whether an MS patient was at risk of disability worsening. As you might imagine, this predictive information could be critically important in developing an individual's treatment plan. We have a long way to go before this tool is ready for prime-time use in a clinical setting, but this development certainly gives us a peek behind the curtain at one of the ways that AI might play a role in future MS treatment. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. While we're on the subject of artificial intelligence, results from a survey conducted by the Cleveland Clinic and telehealth company Amwell reveal that while the overwhelming majority of patients are interested in getting a virtual second opinion following a diagnosis, those results become mixed if AI tools are involved in the diagnostic process. The survey targeted 400 patients who had experienced significant health challenges. And while 89% of the survey respondents indicated that they'd be very or somewhat interested in receiving a second opinion, 40% of the respondents expressed reservations about getting that second opinion if AI tools were used in the process. On the other hand, 23% of the respondents said the use of AI to diagnose medical conditions would make them more likely to seek out a virtual second opinion. There's still much to learn and understand about the role of artificial intelligence in healthcare, and that's clearly reflected in the results of this study. It's interesting to me that 40% of the survey respondents had reservations about getting a medical second opinion if artificial intelligence played a part in forming that second opinion. I have to wonder whether these same folks approach mundane things like search engine results with the same caution. If you use multiple sclerosis as your search term on Google, you'll be directed to many websites offering fact-based, evidence-based, reliable information. You'll also be directed to many websites that just seem to make stuff up, usually in an effort to sell you something, but not always. It amazes me when people read something online, especially something that might be posted to social media, and they simply assume it to be true. That isn't always the case, especially when you dive into those social media posts. And it isn't usually about someone trying to deliberately deceive. It's simply someone getting their facts wrong or substituting their opinion in place of the facts or repeating bad information that they read somewhere online. It happens often. And it's why experts worry when they know the patient community is consulting Dr. Google on a daily basis. Yet when it comes to science-based artificial intelligence, that's the thing that people are skeptical about. It's just my own editorializing here, but I find that ironic. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this survey or even download a report detailing the survey results, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Results of a small study in Iran showed that caffeine may help people living with MS maintain their balance and move more easily. Additionally, it may even improve their quality of life. In this study, 30 adults with MS consumed 200 milligrams of caffeine in tablet form. Now, that's the amount of caffeine you'd find in about 2 cups of coffee. After a 2-week period, during which time the study participants received a placebo, the 30 study participants took the caffeine tablets every day for 12 weeks. Baseline measurements were recorded after the study participants received that placebo for 2 weeks, and then at the end of the study, after 12 weeks of consuming caffeine. The results of the study show that balance significantly improved, both on a stationary platform and a dynamic platform. And in a timed up-and-go test, a test in which each participant was asked to stand up from a chair, walk along a 10-foot line, turn, walk back, and retake their seat, the participants' time improved by an average of 12 seconds, indicating better mobility. Just 2 weeks after starting caffeine, study participants even reported experiencing an improved quality of life. This was a small study, but I'm hopeful we'll see larger studies launched to confirm these results. In the meantime, I sort of hope you're enjoying a cup of coffee while you're listening to this podcast episode. And if you'd like to review the details of the study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. While caffeine may be helpful in improving your balance, there are a couple of terms that have entered the lexicon that are throwing some people with MS off balance. In a moment, we'll be joined by my guest, Professor Alan Thompson, to gain some understanding of what progression independent of relapse activity and smoldering MS are all about. There's a relatively new term being used to describe MS disease activity. The term is PIRA. That's P-I-R-A, and it's an acronym for Progression Independent of Relapse Activity. Many of you may have already heard of PIRA, and some of you have asked me to explain what it means. We're fortunate to have with us one of the leading authorities on multiple sclerosis in the world, Professor Alan Thompson, and Professor Thompson has been gracious enough to join us and shed some light on this new term. Professor Thompson is a clinician scientist who's been the recipient of virtually every high honor and award that's given in the field of multiple sclerosis research, including the John Distel Prize for MS Research in 2017, the Sobeck Research Prize in 2020, and the 2021 Charcot Award, which recognizes a lifetime of achievement in outstanding research into understanding and treating MS. If you've been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, it's very likely that your neurologist relied on the diagnostic standard called the McDonald criteria in making that diagnosis. Professor Thompson has been a key contributor to the McDonald Diagnostic Criteria Committee since its formation in 2001, and I couldn't think of a better person with whom to have today's conversation. Welcome back to the podcast, Professor Thompson.
A pleasure.
I appreciate you taking the time to help my listeners understand something that some of them have already heard or read about, but aren't exactly clear on what it means. We're talking about PIRA, which is an acronym for Progression Independent of Relapse Activity. So how would you characterize PIRA?
Thanks, John. This is it's a very interesting question. So there's a danger that PIRA takes on a life all of its own, and that everyone thinks of it as something completely new that has arrived on the scene and that we now need to try and work out exactly what it means. I mean, I think it's important, first of all, to just remember what the letters stand for, progression independent of relapse activity. So progression is an integral part of the MS journey, if you like. It's a part of what can happen to people with MS. There's nothing new about that. And we know there are some people who have progression from the very beginning of their MS, what we still call primary progressive MS. But that's actually progression, by and large, without relapse activity. So the fact that we have progression independent of relapse activity is not something new, but we are highlighting it. And I think I think the reason we're highlighting it is that when in some of our colleagues in the States and in Europe, and particularly in Basel and in Barcelona, when they looked at patients with relapsing remitting MS, early relapsing remitting MS often, they found that some of them were getting worse without having relapses. So it wasn't as though it was progression later on in the condition. It was happening early in the condition. Now, the fact that progression can occur early, again, is not necessarily new. I think many of us thought that was the case. But I think they have provided very firm evidence to support that concept. So basically, PIRA is progression, independent of anything else. But I think since Ludwig Kapos coined the term about 5 or 6 years ago, what's really important about it is that it is saying that we can get progression in some people early on in the condition within the first 3 to 5 years. And I think that's what makes it important. And it adds an element to it that perhaps we didn't have before. To me, it just emphasizes that progression is a key target and focus for our research and for our therapeutic activities. We need treatments that focus on progression. And what PIRA says is we may need to use those treatments very early on in the condition, which is, again, something many of us have been saying for many years, but this is now giving us evidence. I'm sorry that's a bit long-winded, but it's just to try and put this in context. And the reason I do that is because there are people who think that it is something completely new and something that needs detailed study in a way that perhaps is not quite accurate.
And I appreciate that context. I think some of the confusion among some of the people living with MS that have actually reached out to me has to do with the language that we use to describe MS. I think that many people who have been diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS have a sense that if they're not experiencing a relapse, their MS is therefore lying dormant in remission somehow. And as you pointed out, nothing new has developed here, but perhaps what's happened is the state of the science, I was going to say state of the art, and it may be both, has progressed, has gotten better to the point where now we can see things that perhaps were overlooked many years ago.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's by studying large databases, results from clinical trials, where you get large populations, you can really start to see patterns. And this is important. I'm not for a minute saying that it's not. It's really important. It's important to appreciate that you can have progression. And more importantly, that progression, as is always the case, is associated with changes in disability, with changes on imaging, and with overall a worse outcome. So if you like, it's also a marker or an indicator for active treatment of people that are displaying PIRA. So it's useful in many aspects, but it is a definite move forward, but it's just then keeping it in context.
And so while relapsing remitting MS may describe an individual's symptom experience, it may not be the most accurate way to describe, in terms of everyone, what's actually happening in someone's central nervous system.
Yes. I mean, this raises the challenging issue of the so-called coarse descriptors, which you and I have done a lot of thinking and talking about over the last couple of years. And we appreciate more and more that the terms we use, relapsing, remitting, primary progressive, secondary progressive, are somewhat simplistic labels that don't accurately reflect what's going on underneath the surface and are driving us towards thinking about more biologically based terms to describe what's going on, which is very challenging. But nonetheless, as you say, because we're getting to learn more, we're now in a place where we need to try and apply that knowledge in a way which is more insightful and more sophisticated, I think.
I'd like to ask you about another term that the patient community is hearing more frequently, and that's smoldering MS. What is smoldering MS?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask that because I don't find it a particularly helpful term. I find it a loaded term. And I think while some investigators may use it to describe a gradual change pathologically over time, which is associated with low-grade inflammation, it's sort of being bandied around a lot now as a target for treatments in a way which I think is really unhelpful. So, you know, if a patient was told they had smoldering MS, and I'm not sure anybody would be foolish enough to say that to a patient or to somebody with MS, I think that would worry them. And because it's a kind of a horrible term, to be brutally frank. And it's not very accurate and it's not well understood. And I think we'd be better off putting it away in the cupboard and locking it away just for a little while till we have a better understanding of the underlying pathology of MS. But that's my view, and it probably isn't shared by many of my colleagues.
Well, I'd be more than happy to help lock it away in a cupboard somewhere. I have to admit, I find this to be just a terrible choice of words. The words scare people. When I think of something that's smoldering, I think of a small, unattended fire that's quietly burning and could break out at any moment into a full-on blaze. And if that smoldering is taking place in my brain, I'm ready to run out of my house to find something or someone to put out that fire.
For me, there's also an issue about what is actually being described and how clear we are about the underlying pathology. Because if that's not clear, and I don't believe it is, then it's really unhelpful. Remembering that all that the drive now is to try and understand the pathology of MS and then use our clinical descriptors to better describe that underlying pathology. And in that regard, this is really not a helpful term in my view.
Well, Professor Alan Thompson, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. Thank you for providing some context for some very confusing terms today. And thanks once again for talking with me.
Always a pleasure, John. Thank you very much. Take care.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/339. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.